is hour number two of 3D, ESPN 102.5, The Game, live at the Jack Daniels Barrel House at Bridgestone Arena. Chase McCabe, Ryan Porth here with you. Darren McFarland, Willie Donick will be back here in just a little bit, getting ready for Preds and Stars tonight in this building, the second home game of the season. There's a banner. It got raised on Tuesday. So on to the Western Conference schedule now with the Central Division foe Dallas Stars coming into town. We'll have pregame coverage at 6 o'clock tonight. Ryan, I said before the break that I wanted to ask you about Philip Forsberg. Three games, three goals, 4 points. This is what I wanted to see out of Philip Forsberg to start this season, because, you know, we've seen him have slow starts in years past, and I think that this guy is capable of being a superstar in the NHL. I think we know that. We see him on a daily basis. But now he's playing like it to start the season. I love it.
You mentioned the word superstar, and I wouldn't go that far with Philip Forsberg. I think the superstar category is for guys like Connor McDavid, Sidney Crosby, Evgeny Malkin, Alex Ovechkin, the guys who are the upper echelon of the National Hockey League. Is Philip Forsberg a second-tier or third-tier star in the league? I think he's putting himself in that category. When you look at the playoff run that he had last year with 9 goals in 22 games, and he was so clutch during the first three rounds of that postseason. And then you look at his talent, his ability. You know, he's dynamic, he's clutch, he's well-rounded. When you look at the second half that he had last year, where he scored hat tricks in back-to-back games and put the Preds offense on his back, and then you look at the first three games where he scores that late goal in Boston to get them within one goal. And then Tuesday night, like you said, a huge momentum swinging goal, the fourth goal of the game to make it 5-4 Flyers, and then the winning goal in the last minute of the game to make it 6-5 Preds, which would be the final score. Philip Forsberg is a star in the National Hockey League. I went to Twitter yesterday at Porth Game and made the case that the National Hockey League needs to start realizing what kind of a special player Philip Forsberg really is. He's not marketed as a star. Like, I think with the Nashville Predators, everyone first thinks of P.K. Subban, and they should, because I think P.K. Subban is the best player on this roster. Is Philip Forsberg the second best player on this roster? You can make a case for it. Absolutely. He's that good. He's that talented. I mean, in the third period of Tuesday night's game, I can't remember exactly when it was. I think it was before he scored that fourth goal of the game. He juggled the puck in the offensive zone with guys around him. He juggled the puck on his stick. You don't see every player do that. He is so gifted. And like you mentioned, he had a slow start each of the last two seasons. He now has 3 goals in his first three games. If Philip Forsberg stays hot, we're looking at a 40-goal scorer in the National Hockey League. And 40-goal scorers are stars.
Yes.
And Philip Forsberg, at his age, 23, is a star. He is a budding star, and it's time for the NHL to realize it.
And you just mentioned the big point I was about to make. He's only 23.
And he turned 23 in August.
Yeah, he's only 23. So, I agree. He is a star in the NHL, and who knows? You never know what he can grow into. I mean, I think some of these upper echelon guys like McDavid and Crosby, I mean, they don't come along every day.
They're
special talent.
They're generational.
Right.
McDavid, Crosby, generational. We knew that before the draft, when there is so much hype for Crosby and for McDavid, and both of them have proven it so far.
But I think that Philip Forsberg can definitely be one of the top guys in the league, and he's got some milestones that he's approaching. 94 goals for his career, 195 points. So, I mean, he could be hitting that 100-goal mark here soon. In his NHL career, a very young NHL career, and just bodes well for the Nashville Predators. If they get a 40-goal score for the first time in their history, I think that would be awesome.
I mean, this is a guy that has scored 30-plus goals in back-to-back seasons. He's tied the franchise single-season record with 33 goals in 2015-16. And if he doesn't have a slow first half last year, he could have gotten to 40 goals with the way he closed in the second half. And this is a player that has the talent to score 40 goals and just put the team on his back and carry the offense. And it's not only the offense that makes Philip Forsberg so good. I mean, he's so well-rounded. A couple weeks ago, I went back and rewatched Game 6 of the conference final against Anaheim, and even though he didn't score a goal in that game before his empty netter late in the game, he was so effective with board battles, with, you know, the defensive zone. He is so good in all phases of the game, and that's what makes Philip Forsberg so crucial and so important to this team. And not to mention, he hasn't missed a game in the last 3 years. He's so durable, and with that release of his, you know, Adam Vingan of the Tennessean this morning had a story of Nick Bonino talking about two players that he's been teammates with that has the release like Philip Forsberg has. It's Phil Kessel, who he just played with in Pittsburgh, and Tamu Solani, a future Hall of Famer who he played with in Anaheim. That's high praise coming from Nick Bonino.
That is great company to be in. It's Chase McKay, Brian Porth with you from the Jack Daniels Barrel House here on 3D, talking Predators and Stars tonight. You know, a guy that I wanted to get your opinion on because I respect your hockey opinion with a lot of people. And so that is Mattias Ekholm. And he's a guy that I've always been impressed with. I've always thought he's been a big piece for this team. But when you think of the defensive core, the first three guys that come to mind are Yossi, Ellis, and Subban. And then before Subban got here, it was Weber. So I feel like that Ekholm always kind of gets left out at times. I mean, he's part of that core four, but I don't think he gets the praise that he should. And now with Ryan Ellis out on the sidelines because of injury, I think people are starting to see just how important Mattias Ekholm is for this Nashville Predators team. Would you agree?
100%. And Mattias Ekholm is a guy that last year, you know, we mentioned the word growing pains last segment with the Preds defense. And there were growing pains last year with the defense because of P.K. Subban coming in. You know, Subban and Yossi got hurt midway through the year. They both missed time. But we really saw in the late, you know, later parts of the second half of the season, Mattias Ekholm really rise to the occasion with P.K. Subban being his defense pairmate. And in the playoffs, Ekholm and Subban were awesome. And Mattias Ekholm, I remember NBC during it was either the conference final or the Stanley Cup final. They had a segment in pregame before one of the Preds playoff games asking a question of, is Mattias Ekholm the most underrated defenseman in the NHL? And you can make a case that he's one of the most underrated defensemen in the National Hockey League. Because, like you said, you think of Yossi and Subban and probably Ellis before you think of Mattias Ekholm on that back end.
Right.
But the defensive prowess that Mattias Ekholm has and how strong he can be with the puck and protecting the puck, just like P.K. Subban can be, Mattias Ekholm, I would totally agree with you, is one of the up-and-coming defensemen in the league. I mean, he is 27 years old. He'll turn 28 in May. But this is a guy that they've been high. The franchise has been high on him ever since they drafted him in 09 with the fourth round pick. And we're only seeing him get better. And people who only look at the box score, look at the stats, will see 23 points in 82 games last year for Ekholm and think,
right,
you know, maybe he didn't have quite the season that he should have, considering that he had a career high 35 points the year before. But Mattias Ekholm, like you said, the core four, you can make an argument that he's kind of the glue that holds it all together because of how he can play defensively to combat the offensive prowess of guys like Ellis, Yossi, and Subban.
Well, and I think people lose sight of sometimes that defensemen play defense. I mean, we focus in on that offensive side that, as you mentioned, Yossi and Ellis and Subban bring. But, you know, I look at Mattias Ekholm. He's got 2 points on the year already, which, you know, 2 assists. You like seeing that aspect of his game go up. But he's a defenseman, and he plays defense. And he's one of the better defensemen on this team, you know, outside of that offensive prowess. So I think that's something that people lose sight of. You mentioned the box score. I mean, he's blocking shots. His plus-minus is always kind of where you want it to be. So I think that he should get his just due, and I'm glad to see him getting the spotlight a little bit and helping this team in the absence of Ellis. And I think he's a good mentor to Girard.
I was just going to say that.
They had him playing with Girard the other night, and I thought that was a great move.
That was really smart by the coaching staff to protect Gerard with that situation and have Ekholm right by his side, as opposed to maybe putting Subban and Ekholm together, you know, keeping Subban and Ekholm on the ice for, you know, upwards of 40, 45, even 50 minutes. You have 50 minutes of game time covered by either Subban or Ekholm, with both Josi and Ellis out with injury tonight. And Robbie Stanley of NHL.com just tweeted that Josi doesn't expect his injury to keep him out for long and that it occurred in the Pittsburgh game. But like you said, Gerard, with the offensive mindset that he has right now, it's smart to have Ekholm with him because you can allow Gerard to be aggressive. We saw Gerard even go up there on the forecheck at times Tuesday night against Philadelphia in his NHL debut. You can allow him to do that with Ekholm on the back end and being that security blanket.
So it's looking like, just from based on the lines that we saw at morning skate, it appears that Gerard will be back in the lineup again tonight. We always talk about baby steps. He's 19 years old, playing in his second NHL game. What are you expecting the jump to be from game one to game two?
Well, it's going to be a great test for him against a really good Dallas team. This is an offense that is, you know, hyped up as one of the best in the Western Conference, if not the entire National Hockey League. And you can't really afford to cherry pick games with Sam Gerard. You don't want to play him one game and then have him sit three more and then play him another. You want him to get reps in the NHL consistently for the next couple weeks. Because
and not just leadership reps.
Correct. That would be
right. Oh, wow.
You want him to get on ice reps, as Darren McFarland rejoins
us. I put on the headset and I hear leadership reps.
Well, that's where things go when you leave, Darren. But Sam Gerard, I think we're going to see a lot more from him in the next few weeks, a lot more of what he's made of as a 19-year-old. And what we see in the next couple weeks is going to determine whether or not he stays on the roster for the rest of the year.
I thought it was pretty interesting hearing Braden Gall this morning, Terry Crisp here at the desk. And when asked about Gerard, he referenced Ryan Ellis. He sees a young Ryan Ellis. And, you know, a lot of people will be like, oh, you mean because they're the same size? And no, he just sees a lot of – obviously, whenever you are not your typical big, physical, you know, prototypical, what they want to see – out of, in this case, a defenseman. It's kind of like the quarterback position, right?
Right.
The guys like Russell Wilson, even though they're really, really good, they get told, well, you know, we really like you, but it's always, you know, we wish you were like 6'3", 6'4".
Right, which you can't help.
You can't do that. So what those guys had to do is they had to hear that every level, and they had to do other things superior and better than everybody else just to prove everybody wrong. And what I keep getting, the word that keeps getting used to me, Brent Peterson used this to me on Tuesday. I kind of heard some of this through Crispy this morning, because we know Ryan Ellis possesses this, a high hockey IQ. That's what people are saying about Gerard. Even
right.
though he's 19, they like it. He has a high hockey IQ. And to me, there are certain things coaches can teach, and there's also certain things that they can't. And either you have it or you don't. And to me, that's a good trait to have.
Well, yeah, go ahead, Ryan.
Well, with Ryan Ellis, you know, his first few years in the league, you saw the potential, but that potential wasn't realized yet. And I think Gerard could be going in the same direction and maybe even on a faster track to realizing his potential in the NHL. I mean, it helps that he's getting these on-ice reps, not leadership reps, at 19 years old in the NHL and going up against, you know, guys like Wayne Simmonds and, you know, the big bodies that the Flyers had. And he's going to be thrown into the fire again tonight against a really good Dallas team. And there's no reason to believe that they won't keep him in against, you know, teams like Chicago. And he's going to be facing Philadelphia again next week. You know, these early season games are going to be pretty tough. So this is going to be a good test for Gerard. And like you said, he has a great hockey IQ. You can see it. With Gerard.
You can.
And he had some great moments Tuesday night. He also had some bad moments. Like I mentioned with Chase earlier, you know, he had the costly turnover that led to Philadelphia's second goal. But he also made the really good outlet pass to Johansson, who then flipped it to Forsberg for the Preds' fourth goal of the night. That kind of changed the momentum of that game. So Gerard is a really capable, a really, you know, dynamic player on defense for the Preds. You can see it with him making those spin moves to protect the puck. I mean, he's a fun player to watch. Yeah.
His skating. Well, look, you know, to be put in that spot, especially your first NHL game against the Philadelphia Flyers at 19 years of age, a smaller defenseman, a rookie, your first ever game, you possess a certain skill set that they really, really like, because they know going in, you're not going to be perfect. They right. know you're going to make mistakes, as you just pointed out, Ryan, and it was bound to happen. I mean, he will continue making mistakes, but there's also, you know, huge upside that they see in him that they like to throw him into that spot, because something that I brought up with Brent on Tuesday night, he knows this as a player and as a longtime coach. If the coaches don't trust you, you ain't playing.
Nope.
I don't care what sport it is. If the coaches and if the coaching staff doesn't trust you, and especially at the highest level, you're not playing. And so you have to have a unique skill set and bring something to the table that maybe some of the other guys at that position don't possess, for them to put you in that spot, because they know you're going to make mistakes. And as you said, unfortunately, one of them cost him a goal, but that's going to continue to happen. But what you hope is that he also continues to grow into the role. And you do wonder. I mean, this is something that I brought up with David Poile on Tuesday when he sat here at the desk with us in the third hour. If he just continues to impress and you realize that he is your better option,
yep,
wherever you see him fitting in to a D pairing, whether it's one, two, or three, if he is your better option, are they willing just to say, you know what, the heck with the nine games, we'll just speed up the process and get on with it? Because here's the thing. Before some of the examples, they weren't in that window. They're in a window now. They're in a window to win. And when you come off the highest of highs of a Stanley Cup final, like last year in Game 6, where you played 22 playoff games last season, and you're in that window to win now, you're not worried about what speeding up a year, what that means. You know, you're about keep maintaining and keeping what you already have in place. And if he's your best option, it's not just him. It's every. They're looking up and down the lineup. Who gives us our best options every night? And when you're in that window, that's the decision you make. And I don't think we're in the past. Ryan and Chase, they would have said, look, as much as we think he's ready now, but, look, we need to stick to the process. We're not in that way. You know,
right.
We think we can have a pretty good season. Maybe we'll get into the playoffs. But they weren't thinking of, hey, this guy, this changes our whole season. Where they're in a window now, they don't want to drop off. They want to maintain what they've been doing. And if he's the best option, which I think a lot of us are starting to believe he is, I suspect there's a chance maybe they just keep rolling with him.
I made the case to Chase earlier that Sam Gerard right now, if you include Ellis, Sam Gerard is the fifth best defenseman on this roster. I think you can make the case of that, especially if he continues to play like he did in his debut and in the preseason. I mean, I think it speaks highly of Gerard that the coaching staff and the front office think highly of him to keep him on the roster to start, you know, the season at 19 years old. We haven't seen that a lot with the Preds over the years.
Well, right now, today, he's better than Ryan Ellis. Today, he's better than Ryan Ellis.
Well, yes. That's because Ellis.
Now, ask me in December, and I may have a different answer, but today in October, he's better than Ryan Ellis.
But I would take Gerard over the rest of the depth on that on that defense core right now.
Well, I think, aren't they telling us they would too? That's why he's in there.
Yeah.
Right?
There's no doubt.
I agree.
All right. Willie D has made his way up to the desk. When we come back, Ryan, good stuff. Thank you for hanging out with Chaser.
Always good to see your hair, Darren.
Oh, can you see it?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Oh, that's good, because Chase and Willie are staring at it. I understand. In fact, I got down the locker room, I got a good hair day comment. I'll just leave it at that. Felt pretty good. I was kind of skipping around the locker room. I was like, all righty, this is going to be good. All right, we come back. Richard,
can you tell us who gave you that comment?
No, I will not.
Oh, man, we got to know who did that.
I will not do that.
No, that's that. We've got to have Chase, we need to have an investigation.
I did have
investigative reporting. We're going to find out one way or the other.
I did have a good conversation with Pekka about last night's radio show about the whole sauna comments.
Good.
It was pretty cool. Like, how in Finland, he's like, you know, saunas are like lockers, you know, locker rooms. I mean, just every place. If you got, you live in an apartment, man, they've got a sauna room. You got, that's got to be one of the key ingredients to that apartment complex. That's a big thing in Finland. So that's
big.
That was,
it's
pretty
very big.
Yeah. So, and so that it sparked the conversation, steam room or sauna. Because I prefer the steam room. I told Becca that. I said, I think it's probably, they're both hot. I said, it's probably just because you get the moisture with the steam room.
I like the sauna.
And I feel a little bit more comfortable with the moisture, where the sauna, that dry heat, it's like, I feel like I'm getting choked out in a sauna room.
Yeah, I like the sauna better.
You do?
Yeah.
Huh. Well, you should tell Becca that. You prefer sauna?
I will. What? Apparently, he had the place just rolling last night at the radio show with the sauna comment.
Yeah. So we will come back with Richard Deitch, Sports Illustrated, author of The Media Circus. We do that next on 3D. Back here on 3D, 2D today. Darren McFarland and Willie Donick with you. We're live here at Bridgestone Arena. Predators and Dallas Stars tonight. Puck drop at 7. I'll have pregame starting at 6 right here on 102.5 The Game. Then the Predators will take off for Chicago on Saturday night. They will play the Blackhawks at the United Center. Let's bring in our man. By the way, silly underdog picks coming up in the third hour. Also, Tommy Tuberville. He will be on the call in the booth for the Tennessee-South Carolina game. Richard Deitch from Sports Illustrated, the author of The Media Circus. Richard, how you doing?
I'm good.
So what did the other night mean, Tuesday night, what did that do for soccer in this country, the blow of losing to Trinidad?
And Tobago,
which I think is the population of a city, like Memphis in our state. That's like the population of it. But, you know, not even getting a tie, but not qualifying for the World Cup in, what, 30 years. What has that done for soccer in the States?
I mean, it's bad. There's no other way around it. Just because the World Cup provides you with, you know, one of the great marketing opportunities for your sport that exists, probably the best opportunity, even though the MLS obviously is season-long, market for soccer, and there's other stuff, Champions League, Premier League, et cetera. But, you know, this is the – it's arguably the greatest sporting tournament in the world, depending on how you look at the Olympics versus the World Cup. And so, not that anyone expects the United States to win, but we have, I think, matured as a soccer country to the point where there's an expectation where we're going to make the tournament every 4 years. So it's a devastating moment for U.S. soccer in terms of what is the future of this program and where are they going to go with leadership. You know, when you sort of go beyond that to the media, it's a disaster for Fox. They still have future World Cups, and those future World Cups, particularly if there's one in the States, will be unbelievably successful and profitable. But this is a killer. If you look at the ratings and the viewership for the U.S. games in 2014 and 2010, you know, you're getting double-digit millions for those group stage games, over 10 million, in some points 18 million. You're not going to come close to that in terms of any of these other games, even if it's a big-time team like Spain or Portugal or Germany, et cetera. So, you know, Fox probably loses 25% of its audience, I'd say, as a minimum. But beyond that, they lose momentum for the tournament and for soccer. That's the killer because, you know, the U.S., if the U.S. makes the tournament, just think of how many months there is in terms of marketing and build-up and campaigns. You know, I think it was 2014 when the I Believe That We Will Win campaign came out. And, like, that was like a drumbeat for soccer for, like, 5 months before the actual tournament. So it can't be overstated how bad it is for U.S. soccer. I mean, soccer's not dead in America. It's still going to be a very vibrant sport, and it's only going to grow given the demographics. But you can't really undersell it. It's a terrible, terrible day for and week for U.S. soccer.
We've all at some point in our adult lives Maybe it's big, maybe it was a small purchase, but we've all had buyer's remorse. I suspect Fox has huge buyer's remorse knowing what they know now. But I guess for what you just said, Richard, how does this happen? I mean, how is it our country? I mean, we've done a pretty good job, but you know, the women have been able to do it. The women, even in hockey, have also been able to conquer things that the men can't do for the most part. But what is it about this sport that our country, that prides ourselves on being pretty damn good at everything we do, we just can't get past this one? We cannot really be, I guess, truly competitive when you think about it on the world stage.
Well, a couple things there. First, I don't actually think Fox has buyer's remorse, by
really?
The way, and I'll tell you why. Yeah, no. I mean, I think they're really, like, kind of devastated and have no idea at the moment sort of what to – I mean, listen, they have an idea what to do. They'll broadcast a tournament, but I don't think they have any idea how to market it at the moment. But you got to keep in mind, this tournament – the contractual obligation that Fox has with the World Cup is ultimately going to lead to a U.S. World Cup, I think. Most likely in 2026. That is in whatever they paid in this cycle, they're going to make an infinite amount of money on that tournament, because the viewership for a U.S. tournament in the U.S. will just be insane, and they'll be able to make a ton of money through sponsorship. They also did very, very well with the women's tournament in 2015, record ratings for them, including on FS1, and they made money on that. So, and then finally, keep in mind, they have a relatively new network, and they need programming, and soccer's a big amount of programming for FS1 and FS2. So no, I don't think they're I don't think there's buyer's remorse. I think, though, for this particular cycle, you know, it's whatever, it's going to be a $50 million loss or whatever, but you know, it's Fox. They have seemingly endless amounts of money. In terms of, you know, I think in terms of success, so much of as someone who sort of follows soccer, a lot of the countries in the world are just set up differently than how we are in terms of why their players become as great as they are. And in particular, it's the youth academies that a lot of these, very famous clubs in Europe have that could take the best of the best 6- and 7-year-old. And you put them in like basically an academy where they go to school and they play soccer all the time. I mean, that's the system, I think, to how you get great players. I don't know if that could be duplicated in the States. We have high schools, we have colleges, and we have a country where soccer is not the sport of choice for most of the athletes in this country. Now, I'm not one to say, like, imagine if LeBron James or imagine if Russell Westbrook went into soccer as kids, we'd be the greatest country in the world. Like, there's a guarantee that that would be the case. If you told me every kid only played soccer and no other sports, then yes, based on population, I think the U.S. would have won some World Cups. But I don't know what the solution is in terms of how we're going. I don't know if it's set up for us to be a top four soccer country year after year. I do think, though, and this is what my colleague Grant Wall wrote, if you sort of dedicate a little more professionalism to U.S. soccer in terms of hiring more full-time people at the top, making sure you have a technical director who could sort of run the sort of the overall framework of this from the kid level to the MLS level, then I think it gives you a better shot to get great pools of players, where the coach of the national team ultimately can choose, can choose a player. Finally, and again, this is not to excuse the U.S. team, but it's a little bit of a fluke what happened. They got themselves in trouble by actually having the Trinidad and Tobago game mean something. That's on the U.S. players and program, et cetera. But so, you know, literally, like, so many things odds-wise had to happen that night for them to be eliminated, and just by randomness, it all happened. You flip the Mexico score around. If you guys watch the game, the U.S. had a shot that hit the post with about 15 seconds left. That goes in, and they go to the they go into a sudden death elimination against Australia. So a lot of things conspired against them for them to be in this position. But, you know, make no mistake, they lost the World Cup in the games leading up to this game. And that should not be the case in CONCACAF, which, generally speaking, is a very forgiving and easy region. So, you know, the players and the administration have no one to blame but themselves. But with all that said, it still ended up, you needed one of the craziest nights in qualifying history for the U.S. not to make it.
Did you want to say something about that?
Well, you got me interested, Richard, in talking about how we develop the athletes. Because Bob Ryan from the Boston Globe years ago was the first one who sort of put forth the whole question of we do it so differently than the rest of the world, not specifically with soccer, but with all of our sports. And we were doing it more in the context of the cheating that goes on in the NCAA. But he's like, this is how we want it, right? We want to have the ability to root for our school, even if there's some stuff that goes along with that, the competitiveness and the cheating that goes with it, where you're tying academics to athletics. Whereas in Europe, and really all around the world, especially with soccer and with tennis, right? We have this discussion with tennis, U.S. tennis as well, that the clubs, the academies, going forward, it's always been separate from where you go to school. So that's really the central question, right, is – do we need to do I'll give you another example, hockey in Canada, right? You leave home at a very early age there. If you're really good, you're probably gone from your home by 14 or 15 years old to play hockey and go to school elsewhere. But
correct,
we're so tied to rooting for our school and the high school system and the college system, it's hard to break away from that.
Yeah, I mean, listen, the college system and high school system works for certain sports for us to be the dominant nation. Basketball is the perfect example. The best players know that they're going to go to the AAU route and they play against each other and they get better. They know that they're at least for 1 year going to go the NCAA route, and that's sort of the filter system. In tennis, you know, in at least in this country, when we have a great sort of run, generally speaking, it's a group of players who go to private academies. They play against each other from like ages like, you know, 9 to 17, and that's how they get good, and then they go on the tour, and, you know, some of them make the top 10, some of them don't, but that's the system. In Europe, you know, Leo Messi went to the Barca Academy and played with all these great players from the time he was 8 years old, and then by the time he's 17, he's on the main team of Barcelona. By 18, he's starting, and he then plays for Argentina, and he's one of the best players in the world because he has this club system. I don't know how that, for U.S. soccer, is going to manifest itself outside of, and this is the caveat, is that you probably, the way to get better players, at least by the way the system is set up, is one, identify the kids who are great at soccer early, and hopefully they're committed to it, and two, but this is asking so much on parents, it's to basically go to Europe or to go to other countries where they have these kind of developmental systems and play in those academies. So, you know, like if you're you know, you're a great player and you play for one of these German youth club teams like Bayern Munich or Dortmund or something like that, or Leverkusen, and then the U.S. player at 18 or 19 is playing in like the top league, German league, or the top Spanish league, and then they come back to the States as 19 and 20-year-olds and, you know, are top flight players. And, you know, hopefully you get 10 or 11 of those guys. But it's not going to be easy for soccer. I mean, I think we can get a little better, to the point where, you know, to me, given our population, we should be a top 15, top 20 squad every year. But, you know, I don't subscribe to the sort of American exceptionalism somehow that because we're America, we should be number one and we're going to be number one. I just don't buy it. We're not a soccer culture. You know, you have kids in certain countries, in Germany, in Spain, in Chile, or, you know, which didn't make it, but I'll just use that as an example, in Uruguay, where, like, there are kids, like, at, you know, age three, just playing, like, every day on the streets of those, you know, on those streets or in the communities where, you know, you get 11 kids to go to the park or whatever, or the green. That's what they do. That's not the case here in the States. It's just there's too many other options for kids, from different sports to video games. So I don't see it. I think soccer is a really interesting, uniquely creative sport where the greatest goal scorers of all time are kind of like musical prodigies and geniuses. You know, they just figure out different angles and they see the field and the lines differently. I we as a country have been much more very technical. You get guys who are great athletes who can run all day, you know, a lot of times sort of kick the ball down the sides and sort of outwork or outgut other teams. Now, that should be enough to make the World Cup every year, but I just do not believe, and again, I could be proven wrong, but having been a soccer fan and watcher for a long time, I just do not believe that our country is set to eventually beat the Germanys and the Spains and the Italys and the countries that have been true soccer powers for generations.
Richard Deitch, SI.com, on the line with us. Jemele Hill suspended 2 weeks for a second violation of social media guidelines at ESPN. What did you think about that story this week?
Yeah, I mean, listen, you know, we could do 5 hours on this topic, because it's pretty multi-layered and complex. I'm not even sure where to go. I guess for the purposes of being a little quick.
Well, let me ask this, Richard, real quick before you go into this. I've said it, you know, we've said it many times on this show. You know, follow you on Twitter. You're a good follow. You're a guy wide ranging, as all of our listeners know. When you come on here, basically, we can toss anything in your lap and you can run with it. So you're a guy that has opinions, but you also work for Sports Illustrated. You're an employee. So what are you allowed to do? What are you allowed to do? Because you're a guy that's not afraid on social media to get out there and get involved in conversations. That's kind of your job too, is to also follow this stuff. So what are your boundaries in what you can do, Richard Deitch, with your own social media accounts?
Yeah, I mean, I think the overall boundary is not to embarrass the parent company, which is, in my case, Time Inc. Where it gets to Jemele Hill, and this is always sort of tricky terrain, is ESPN historically has been, you know, you can do a lot of things as an ESPN employee. The one thing you generally can't do is to criticize ESPN or to start screwing with their money. And that's sort of the line where Jemele Hill went to with her comments on Twitter. But it's pretty important here to, I think, be nuanced. Obviously, your employer has the right. You have a First Amendment right to speech, and then your employer has the right, private sector employer, to discipline you if they feel that you have said certain speech somewhere that is not, whatever, befitting of the company or violates your contract, et cetera, et cetera. So we know all that. ESPN has the right to do what they want. I don't argue that. What is interesting, though, here is what Jemele Hill tweeted. And this is where you, I think, subjectively have to make your decision. Do you read that as she tweeted out that people should boycott these companies, which also have business relationships with ESPN? And obviously, ESPN has a major business relationship with the NFL. It's their most important relationship. If ESPN doesn't have that relationship with the NFL, ESPN is an ESPN. So that's one read. And if you read it that way, you're like, they should suspend her forever, they should fire her, blah, 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 blah. If you read it another way and you say, she's making the point that the most effective way to clap back or protest Jerry Jones saying that my players are going to line up and salute or stand for the flag. You know, he's demanding that as an employer, as an owner. If you read her take as saying, hey, the way to sort of get back at that is to boycott this guy in the pocketbook because the players probably can't do it. So if you want to make your voice known to a guy like Jerry Jones, what you do is you hit him in his wallet, and that's sort of the best way to make your point. Now, that's not her coming out and saying, don't patronize AT&T, don't patronize Coors, don't patronize Volkswagen. That's her saying this is the effective way to protest. So to me, as management, depending on how you read that, is ultimately how you're going to make your decision. ESPN obviously read it as this is an attack on our business. They suspended her 2 weeks. I also think part of that was, as I've always said on your show, I think they like to send messages to employees where they say, do not screw with the business, do not screw with the money, do not touch the third rail. So it's pretty interesting to me because I think you could actually read what she tweeted different ways. And having reported this out a little bit, I can give your listeners, I think, a honest account. I do not believe Jemele Hill that night went out to tweet as an activist and to try to sort of cause a something larger. I think she was just basically matter-of-factly saying, hey, this is kind of the way to go if you really want to hit guys like Jerry Jones. But, you know, I'll just end with this. ESPN is screwed. I mean, really massively screwed, and here's why. They have antagonized people on the right and those who are waving the flag there because there is that perception out there that they're left-leaning and that they're trying to shove social issues down your face. And now they've antagonized people on the left who are like, you've silenced and chilled one of your employees, particularly a very popular employee is a person of color, and you don't have the backs of people like us. So they're in this spectacularly bad position of alienating essentially both sides of the political spectrum. And that is where they are now, and that is a horrible place to be. And to be honest with you, I don't know how they're getting out of that so soon. I think they suspended Jemele Hill, in all honesty, in part, because I think they wanted the news cycle to go away for the moment. And, you know, it'll go away today, and it'll go away tomorrow, but it's not going away forever, and it's certainly not going away forever as long as Donald Trump's in the White House. So I'll just be totally blunt with you. They're screwed. They do not have an easy out on this because, in my opinion, they have alienated both sides of the political spectrum with their decisions. So they are, you know, again, the business can be fine. They make a lot of money still, but they have become part of a major, major culture war, and I do not see that going away anytime soon.
Good stuff as always. Richard, really appreciate it. Have a good rest of your week, and we'll do it again next week.
You got it. By the way, Yankees Astros.
Oh boy. Do we really need to go there? No. I wanted to avoid
the Zinger on the way out.
Yeah, thanks.
New York is back. We finally have a winning team.
All right, Richard Deitch, Sports Illustrated. It was so good until the very, very end.
If we had more time, I would love to hear his take from just being in New York, the 180 that I'm sure the Yankee fans did on Joe Girardi.
Yeah.
You know, John Smoltz was talking about it the other day. He says there was not a single Yankee fan that called a talk show after that game when they were down 2-0 and back in New York on the off day. He said they were absolutely roasting him.
Of course.
And now 3 games later, they're moving on.
And as Richard said, the news cycle has moved on in New York about
yes.
That. We'll come back and wrap up the second hour of 3D next. A lot to digest from Richard Deitch. By the way, Steve Durham on Twitter tweeted at us, Willie, to ask Richard about Puck Daddy, which he's no longer Puck Daddy. He's Greg Wyshynski, moving to ESPN, and how that changes the NHL media landscape. It's a really good question. We unfortunately got into so much good stuff with Richard we weren't able to get to. We had many more things to get to.
Yes.
We needed at least an hour today with Richard to get through everything. But it's a good question by Steve. Maybe we'll reach out. Greg is obviously a friend of the show. We've been dealing with him for a long time, and Puck Daddy was at Yahoo Sports. Greg Wyshynski is now at ESPN, and so this is an interesting hire because I am thrilled about this, but I thought this is what ESPN was going away from, right? I mean, I thought they were going away from content. It was more TV-driven. I didn't think they valued, I guess,
but Greg,
content and the website nearest me because look at all the people they let go. Remember when we were
right. –
I don't remember where we were. I think St. Louis, I think it was probably about round two, that big day happened where they let, 100 people go and some pretty prominent names that we've known, followed, read over the years.
Greg is unique, though, in that he's always had, I think, that creativity. He's had that niche that goes beyond just being a reporter. He has been more of a blogger who I think has gained a lot of credibility and therefore has now weaved back into a little more traditional way of covering teams as well. But he's always had that fun angle of being able to find the lighter side of things, working in a lot of video, and I think that was appealing to ESPN. I think it's a great move. The other thing I'm noticing with a lot of hockey writers, and Scott Burnside, our –
yes.
We go way back with Scott. Uh-huh. He now is working with the Dallas Stars. He's a little bit more like what Jim Wyatt did, newspaper guy, now working for a team's
website. That's a great
website.
Example right there.
But a lot of the hockey writers are jumping into this athletic
yes.
network as well. That's something to ask Richard about next week, too. I've been meaning to do it, and I haven't seen him write much about it, but I'm curious of what he thinks that dynamic is going to look like, not just for hockey, but for sports journalism.
And it's coming to Nashville. Well, there's just no way. You can't. Well,
somebody's going to have to take the mantle and make it happen.
You can't ignore this market. There's just no way. I mean, I know they're moving it. They're not everywhere. So the question I have is I don't know enough about them. Like, who's paying for all this? I mean, it seems like they're spending a lot of money.
Subscriptions.
Yeah, but somebody has to, Willie, somebody's got to be the pockets behind it.
Investors.
Who is anybody we know? I mean, who's these are deep pockets. Whose pockets are they?
I don't know. I think there need to be investors in each city. I don't know if there's an overall engine that
you
drives it.
You don't think so?
Well, it's like starting up any
business. Do you think they're a franchise? I mean, they're just franchising out each market?
I don't know. But I don't think it's that different than starting up any other kind of business.
That's what I'm getting at. We don't know the business model of the Athletic. We know that it's becoming a driving force in our industry.
I don't know if it is or not. It's in the young stages.
But it's out there.
There's some people that there are a lot of good writers that have committed to it.
Well, I think, you know, Ken Rosenthal isn't that. I mean, he grabbed the baseball world when he left to do that. I mean, that they have captured some big names.
Again, it's a question for Richard.
I'd like to know more about their business model.
There are
a lot of
very good beat writers in various cities that have left the newspaper to go cover that same team for the Athletic rather than the newspaper.
Right.
So we're talking about very good writers, in my opinion. So they had to be recruited and sold on this is the better direction to go moving forward than staying at the newspaper. Not all of them have, but quite a few of them have.
But getting back to the tweet, does this change much for ESPN, do you think?
Getting back to Wyshynski going to ESPN?
Yes.
I think it's going to be a long way to go before hockey fans give any kind of nod to ESPN for hockey coverage. But this certainly helps. Wyshynski has a big, big following, as we know.
We know him well. Adam Vinken just texted both of us and said Silicon Valley types are bankrolling the Athletic.
Can always count on Adam for knowing the inside.
I don't doubt his info. That makes sense. But that's what I want. I want to know a little bit more about them. Like, it's just, I mean, you start hearing all this Athletic,
and
Athletic.
Are
okay,
these people?
Who's the driving force behind it? What is their mission? What are they trying to eventually accomplish? Like, how big do they have? You know, what is their business model? What is their goal? You know, it's always interesting. You know, when Peter Keene, when MMQB first started, you have no idea where it's going. Now you don't think twice about what he's doing and the driving force behind MMQB. Same thing with the Tribune, right? At first it was like, well, this is interesting, the Players Tribune. But now, I mean, look at it today. But you don't ever know really where it's going to go. I'd be curious to know more about the Athletic. We'll come back.
And are they athletic? Do they have athletic ability?
Ooh.
The founders of the Athletic.
Yeah, I don't know. Good question. We'll come back and do silly underdog picks. Also, Tommy Tuberville. An active third hour of 3D. That's next.